I won't say too much about the debates the strike arouses, because I think that they will be discussed as the day goes on. What I will say is that the UWC stoppage of May 1974 remains one of the most important events of the Troubles. It ended Northern Ireland's first experiment of power sharing for a generation. Not for nothing did its repeat and resuscitation in 1998 become regarded by some as Sunningdale for slow learners. The strike's success and defiance of the UK, Irish and Northern Irish legislatures, as well as the British Army and the IRUC, led to the stoppage being labelled as, without doubt, one of the most successful political actions carried out by any European working class since the World War. Yet it remains remarkably free from historical and written focus, bar a few journalistic accounts and one extraordinary play, Stuart Parker's 1987 work, Pentecost. And we're delighted to say that later on, two of the actors from the original productions, one by Field Day in Derry and one by the Tricycle Theatre in London, are coming in to talk about that later on. Well, generally, we're determined today that today highlights a broad range of views and themes about May 1974, not just from the strike leaders, but also from those within the Sunningdale executive, such as key civil servants, nationalists from the SDLP, Republicans, as well as further perspectives from civilians and writers. One of the things I think which will emerge from today is that the strike was a very complicated, diverse thing. And the weakness of analysis so far is to simplify it either way. Similarly, industrial workers as well as loyalists are involved. While British Prime Minister Ted Heath was not entirely correct to say in his memoirs that Ian Paisley had nothing whatever to do with the strike, it's often forgotten that Paisley was actually in Canada for its first week, as it was said he was gauging whether or not the stoppage would be a success. He did arrive back to participate, but it was the failed follow-up attempt of 1977 which came to be regarded as Paisley's strike. Many confused the two. And for the reason, and for this reason, the memory of the UWC strike of 1974 should not be monopolised by any one name. There was even a famous story of involving Ian Paisley and a chair during the first coordinating committee of the UWC, which I hope that Glenn will tell us about in a few moments' time. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce him as a major player in the leadership and momentum of the May 1974 strike. There'll be some time afterwards, especially now Andy Tyrie is not able to join us, to ask questions and make contributions yourselves on the floor. We're very keen to hear from you. So first up is Glenn, who has always pointed out that he emerged first and foremost from a trade union background. However, it was as chairman of the Ulster Loyalist Central Coordinating Committee at the time of the UWC stoppage where he first came to prominence across the province. Previously, he'd been elected as Assembly Member for Londonderry and became associated for several years with the Vanguard Party under Bill Craig. Glenn went on to found the Ulster Political Research Group, producing in 1979 the document Beyond the Religious Divide, which was a creative and underrated document which advocated negotiated independence, an American-style constitution and a Bill of Rights, and also, critically, power-sharing. He also wrote poetry, which he was good enough to share with me when I met him, and after leaving public life, returned to Londonderry to work in, amongst other initiatives commemorating shared history of the First World War, community schemes aiding disadvantaged young people. He was awarded an OBE and continues to work as chief executive at the International School for Peace Studies in his home city. And it's my privilege to ask Glenn to get us underway today.
First of all, let me apologise for being late. And as I said to Cole on the phone, why is it that when Belfast people organise meetings in Belfast, it's 9 o'clock in the morning, but when they organise it in Londonderry and places like that, it's a 10:30? I know excuses given to us poor people having thought the whole way up from over the Glen Shane Pass, but we got here eventually and haven't lost ourselves in Belfast since you started block off roads. And we weren't the only people to block off roads. I see the DOE's at it now as well. And we had to do an about turn. So I'm here. I have a sore throat, so I don't know how long I'll last. Can I just say that Queen's brought me out of retirement 2 years ago, speaking on behalf of the UDA. And Cole succeeded in doing it today again. And I was back into semi-retirement. I've been trying to put some things together, and this is probably the worst piece of paper I've ever had to put together because of the fact that it's 40 years ago. And the thing about it was that the very famous Wilson speech, in which we all thought we were going to be interned, led to the point where all my notes were destroyed in case the authorities got their hands on them. And that, unfortunately, has been a piece of history that's been lost to us. And the only thing that was left was my last day's notes, and not very exciting. But all the other stuff, which involved the setting up of subcommittees that we had set up to take over the strike, and the inventiveness being interned, the names and addresses of all those people were all destroyed, and also their second committee. So we can appreciate, in those days we didn't keep notes. The idea was you destroyed everything you wrote. And unfortunately now, at 72 years of age, my memory is not what it used to be. So with the aid of a friend of mine here in Queens, he gave me a few dates, but I'm sure you know all the dates out of it yourself, and I think you'll be more interested in the details, if I can remember as much as I possibly can. How did I come to be involved and what happened? In 1972, we had a delegation, 16 people went to the House of Commons to lobby the MPs in relation to the upsurge in Republican violence. And I was one of the three-man delegation that was selected to put our case to Regular Modelling, the then Home Secretary. We spent about an hour and a half with Modelling, and he made commitments and promises to us in relation to the rumours that were circulating throughout Northern Ireland that the B Specials would not be disbanded and the RUC would not be disarmed. And I suppose a bit like the end of the Second World War, or the beginning of the Second World War, we headed off with this piece of white paper thinking this was it, done deal, and that the British Army would be strengthened to oppose the nationalist and the Republican campaign. 2 weeks later, not only did we not get the protection for the B Specials and the police force, the RUC, the B Specials were disbanded, the RUC was disarmed, and not only that, but our legitimate and constitutional parliament was abolished by Westminster. Without any consultation, without any thoughts about how this was going to leave the Protestant loyalist people at home. And I vowed at that time that never again would I trust an English politician. And I'm now 72 years of age, and since that time I have never done that. I indeed went on to declare in the House that after I was elected in 73 that I'm a first-class Ulster man. I'm not a second-class Englishman, and I've no intentions of becoming a third-class Irishman. And later, I went on to stress when I was in Stormont that I have become an Ulster nationalist, and I hold that view to this day. And it's all because of Reginald Modelling and my distrust of English politicians. And that led on to all the work that I did do then in relation to the independence and the whole concept of the people of Northern Ireland, putting Northern Ireland first, and working out our political structures to ensure that everybody participated in the responsibilities and the decisions of the state, and protected by a Bill of Rights. And I believe that if we had gone down that road, we might have saved a lot of the deaths that occurred in this country. It was because of my mistrust of politicians that I changed my whole attitude to what we should be doing here in Northern Ireland. And I came about as well from the fact, as Colin has stated, that my ground was in the trade union movement. I never wanted to be a politician. I wake it up one day and I was a politician, or somebody told me I was. I never believed them. But it happened because when the going got tough out there on the sticks, loyalist politicians all run for cover. Our churches were abysmal, had no record whatsoever of being involved with our communities. And our communities were left leaderless. There was nobody in the communities to give leadership to the loyalist people. And so people like myself and others throughout the country were thrown up to try and give some responsibility and leadership to our people. And so with that in mind, I felt that never again would I trust anybody with my security, and never again would I trust anybody, particularly English politicians, with the future of my country. And I later made a statement in the House when I said that I had no intentions of fighting British soldiers to remain British, but I'd fight everybody or anybody to stay out of United Ireland, and I still hold that view today. From the outbreak of the Troubles in 1968 until 1974, the Unionists believed that they had suffered a series of political defeats and the failure of security forces to defeat the IRA, and now then the plans of the British government for a whole new administration in Northern Ireland, which suggested that people like Gerry Fitt, John Hume, and the SDLP were going to be in our government. And these were the very people who had been instrumental in the destruction of our country and the destruction of our democratically attracted government. They were also there now making political gains in the back of the IRA. And as far as we were concerned, the process had to be stopped. So as I say, in 1973, the government issued the White Paper on Ireland's constitutional proposals, which included plans for a Royal Ireland Assembly elected by PR, and the stipulation that the executive should have widespread support, and crucially, given how events had developed, that a Council of Ireland must operate with the consent of both the majority and the minority. That's a bit of a turnaround when you think in 1972 they wiped our government out, disbanded our security forces, and never had one word to talk to us about it. It was around this time that Bill Craig, Vanguard leader, wrote to the party members stating, quote, "If the executive can't be prevented from getting new proposals off the ground as a credible institution, it will survive long enough to bring the unification of Ireland meaningfully closer." Craig believed that Unionist opposition in the Assembly would be ineffective, as it could be ignored by the Secretary of State, and that the campaign would be won or lost in the country. Significantly, he added, "The form of organisation is all important. It must provide a coming together and must be free of the personality cult. People must be able to identify without feeling disloyal to the existing commitments without having to join an already identifiable organisation. A loyalist action council or central body to which constituency associations or political parties could affiliate seems a necessary starting point, be followed by action groups in every country, every county, town, village and factory, and suitable workplace." One form of opposition was clearly on the loyalist agenda was an industrial stoppage. And as I say, I'm a bit of a sore throat, so I keep have to take a wee drop of water. The stoppages had worked well for Vanguard in March 1972, at the time of the suspension of Stormont. But it proved disastrous in February 1973, when a protest strike against the internment of UDA members had been characterised by widespread violence. The consequences of the February 1973 strike was the effective collapse of the Loyalist Association of Workers, and now attempts were being made to create a new Loyalist Workers' Organisation. An early indication of this came on the 2nd of November, when the Belfast Telegraph reported on the formation of a group called East Antrim Loyalist Workers, which had split from LA Dubna and which significantly included Ballylumford Power Station. At that time, there was a whole international problem with power cuts and the Yom Kippur War between Syria and Israel, and crucially the Arab oil producing states began increasing prices, and so there was sort of mayhem all over the world at that time, but more particularly in the UK. And I can remember to this day, and I'm sure I see my old friend Maurice Hayes there, remember effectively one distinguished Lord in Parliament, Stormont, who made an effort for us to save fuel, and whereupon, in his statement in the House, he dropped his trousers to show us all that he was wearing his long johns, and he said that we should all adopt the same attitude. I think he was the only one that took up the idea himself. But this certainly had serious problems all over the country, and there's no doubt that the difficulty came in the 1973 elections, in which Harold Wilson was defeated, and we got what do you call that? Well, the Conservative Party came in, and he was defeated in February after that, and Wilson then took over. The whole election in February 1974 was the question of who governs Britain. However, and the result had failed, and the result failed to produce a clear winner, and the Conservative leader, Edward Heath, post-election attempts to reach an agreement with the Liberal Party failed, and on the 5th of March, a minority Labour government led by Harold Wilson took power. By the 20th of November that year, the government's white paper plans for Northern Ireland still appeared to be progressing, when the Ulster Unionist Council narrowly voted not to reject power sharing. And late November also saw the meeting at Vanguard headquarters of a group that would eventually become the Ulster Workers' Council. Loyalist trade unionist Harry Murray had been invited to the meeting to represent Harland and Wolfe and agreed to participate in the new organisation provided politicians and paramilitaries were not represented. Although Murray's proposal was agreed to, the reality was that paramilitaries and politicians remained close to the workings of the new group, if not an integral part of it. One of Harry's closest allies in the following months, for example, was Bobby Pagels, who was a prominent UDA member. And what emerged, therefore, was a situation where there was a rough compromise between workers, paramilitary and political groups as to who was to lead or play the primary role in the campaign against Sunningdale. In the longer term, this also led to competing claims from the various elements as to who was the real force behind the strike. By this time, Andy Terry, who had originally been elected as the temporary chairman, for want of a better word, was elected as temporary chairman to avoid a split between Hard and Smith in the west and Tommy Hearn in the east. And Andy is now well established as the chief and was slowly building a team around him to deal with all aspects of life in the Royal Studios. I was not present at the inner council meeting that took the decision to appoint Andy, but as the political spokesman for the organisation, I was called in immediately afterwards and informed of the decision of council. As was well known at that time, there was attempts in Andy's life, and as political spokesman, I came out publicly in support of Andy Terry. And not only over the years that him and I worked very closely together, but we also became great personal friends. I suppose he's not here to defend himself, but Andy's an unassuming character, those of us that know him very well, with a magnetic personality. And I think the press in those days would tell you that. We got our message across, but in most cases, we didn't take life too seriously at that time. And that's not in order to play down the accent of the organisation or how we felt about things. But I think that he and I both never really fully appreciated the position that we had held, and therefore we could always see the day when we had returned back to the shop floor. Me continued with my trade union future, I hope, and Andy was going back to his garden. Unfortunately, we weren't allowed to do that. But what he did do was restructure the entire organisation. He immediately set up structures to look after various elements within the organisation, like welfare, community development, and of course he was very much involved with me in the political side. And he had done it very effectively, and the attempts that were made in his life did not in any shape, form or fashion put him off the track that he believed was the best for the organisation and the best for the people of Northern Ireland. And all the years that I've known him, his total commitment has been to providing a better way of life for our people. He had then been approached, the workers had been around the various political parties and trying to promote this concept of a strike. And in 1973, Andy had asked me, he set up, he contacted all the paramilitary leaders on the Loyalist side to set up a political think tank, and they asked me to chair it. And in 1973, early 1973, we met on a regular basis in the Royal Bar of the Shankill. So the contact between ourselves and that coming together of the Parliament of the Groups and the Loyalist side had already started. As the Sunningdale process progressed, Unionist opposition also coalesced with the formation of both the political umbrella, the United Ulster Unionist Council, and the paramilitary equivalent, the Ulster Army Council. Although the Sunningdale communique outlined the provision for a Council of Ireland was by the 16th of December, when Austin Ardle told RTE that it fulfilled Wolfe Tone's desire to break the connection with England. And Taoiseach Liam Cosgrave told the Sunday Press that there was no question of the Republic changing its territorial claims to Northern Ireland. The trend of growing opposition, Unionist opposition to Sunningdale, became even clearer on the 18th of December when the North Tyrone Unionist Association, which was seen as a weather vane of UUP opinion, voted by a ratio of 2-1 to support the Sunningdale candidate, the anti-Sunningdale candidates. And even the pro-Faulkner Belfast Telegraph was now predicting that he would be defeated on the Sunningdale issue when the Ulster Council was to meet on the 4th of January 1974. Despite this, the anti-Sunningdale opposition was still not focused on a single objective. And on the 22nd of December, for example, the UDA blocked roads in protest against the treatment of Loyalist prisoners. But in mid-February 1974, meanwhile, two UDA men were shot dead by the army and a third wounded during riots in East Belfast. On the 4th of January, it was widely predicted, Faulkner lost the Unionist Council vote on the proposed All-Ireland Council settlement and resigned as party leader 3 days later. Alarm bells were now ringing in Belfast and London. And on the 17th of January, senior civil servant Sir Ken Bloomfield, I'll see later on, wrote a political brief for Faulkner in which he warned that unless Sunningdale could be ratified with the consent of the majority of the Protestant community, it may not long survive on any useful basis. And later that same day, however, SDLP Assembly member Hugh Logue told a Dublin audience that the Council of Ireland was the vehicle that would trundle us into United Ireland. The public decision of Sunningdale was delivered on the 28th of February in the UK general elections. The Treble UC won 11 of the 12 Northern Ireland seats with 51% of the vote. The incoming minority Labour government, which had many other problems to deal with, were well aware that the early implementation of the Council was highly unlikely, but were unable to convince either the SDLP or the Irish government of this hard reality, and Faulkner's position continued to erode. On the 7th of March 1974, the newsletter mentioned the Ulster Workers' Council for the first time when the UWC challenged the new Secretary of State, Merlin Rees, to attend a victory rally for the Treble UC general election on candidates to be held at Stormont that Saturday afternoon. On the 12th of March, anti-Sunningdale Unionists tabled a motion in the Assembly calling for the renegotiation of the Sunningdale Agreement. On the 23rd of March, the UWC issued a statement threatening widespread civil disobedience unless fresh Assembly elections were called, but elsewhere in Northern Ireland, tensions were further heightened by a renewed IRA bombing offensive, and March saw the greatest number of security incidents of any month in 1974, and that was a total of 921 incidents, as well as the greatest number of explosions. 2 weeks later, against this background, Northern Ireland officer ministers Merlin Rees and Stanley Orme met the UWC representatives of Stormont in what was already an angry meeting between the two of them. Division within the Sunningdale camp still continued, however, and the paramilitaries were angry at not being included in the Treble UC conference held in Portrush between 24 and 26th of April. Significantly, however, the conference saw Harry Murray and Billy Kelly being included as members of the Treble UC study group, set up to devise a blueprint for selective sanctions as a means of implementing the will of the people. The question of a strike in opposition to Sunningdale was now becoming more immediate. And over the winter, Billy Kelly of the Power Workers was pushing for an immediate strike, while Harry Murray wanted to wait until the spring, partly to reduce the hardship a strike would cause. By May, the weather had improved, while it also appeared that the success of the WC candidates in the general election had also had no impact whatsoever on the Sunnydale and that other actions might now be required. Things were getting desperate at that time. And I remember that, again, my water, just pure water, I'll tell you. Bill Craig and I were sitting at the front benches at Stirmit, and the SDLP were sitting opposite, and one after the other got up, and they had been, without shadow of a doubt, the most powerful team of politicians I've ever seen assembled at any time. One after the other got up and spoke without a note for 15 minutes on every subject that was affecting us, and they were absolutely superb, brilliant they were, without a shadow of a doubt. And Craig turned to me and he said, "Glenny, I've just been thinking." He says, "Willie Whitelaw could defeat our whole campaign against the Sunnydale Agreement." And I says, "What do you mean, Bill?" He says, "He could defeat the whole thing in one foul swoop." I says, "How's he going to do that?" He says, "He could ask us to form a government." And I says, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, look behind you." He says, "How the hell could you form a government with that?" And I looked behind me, seriously, and I looked at what was behind us and what was in front of us, and there was no comparison whatsoever. We just could not compete with the SDLP. And I'm sorry to say that it appears that the same thing is happening today with people who had no place in politics at all being thrust into positions in politics because of their association with one organisation or another. It was just after that that the UWC asked to talk to Andy. I wasn't involved, I was at home. And they apparently had asked Andy to support the strike and use the UDA to do that. And when I was in Belfast most nights, if I didn't make it down home, I stayed with Andy. And I was staying that night with him. And sorry, I came up from Londonderry and I was staying in Belfast. And he told me that he had a meeting with the WC leaders. And they were looking for the UDA to back the strike. And I says, "Well, when is the strike?" He says, "They don't know. There's no decision taken yet. And there's a whole argument between them about when they will have the strike." Well, I said to him, "You know, Andy, if the strike is going to be pinpointed against the Sunnydale Agreement, the time to have the strike would be the 14th of May, whenever the vote is being taken in Stirmit, whether we support it or not." And he says, "Well, what'll that do?" I says, "Well, we're going to be defeated. We can't win it. We don't have enough votes in the House to win it." So after I convinced him of that, he says, "Right, that'll be it." So we called the UWC, and he set the date for the 14th of May. Up until that time, there was no date set. And as history shows, the ball started to roll. And on the 14th of May, Harry Murray went into the House, into Stirmit, and declared that the strike would start. I was making a note of this the other day because something very eerie happened. Because that day, Hugh Smith and I weren't in the House for the vote. Hugh and I were at Long Case visiting the UDA and the UVF prisoners. And after we finished the tour of the Case, I had went on home. So I had been writing this down about Hugh and myself when I got the news that Hugh had just died. And I thought, well, that's a very eerie thing that happened. Hugh and I had forged a great relationship. And a lot of what changed and made up my mind about politics was during the whole campaign against Sunnydale, the WC Paisley then took a decision that we would not be allowed in over the bar of the House. And so we were effectively barred from going into to the Parliament and into the House. Hugh and I used to go to the Public Gallery and listen to the debates that was taking place. It was plain to be seen in anybody's face that there was no harmony in that executive. And you could see that there was political splits. I don't mean religious political splits. I mean there was political splits that was occurring within that executive. people like Paddy Devlin became a great personal friend of mine, and Jerry Fitt, who were coming from a trade union background, who were coming from a working class background, like myself and Huey. And so it wasn't hard for us to develop a lasting friendship with those fellas. And I always remember John or Jerry later when we had a vote on the voluntary coalition. He said to me, he says, Lenny, the problem I have is I'll not use the exact words that Jerry used. You know, Jerry could use a few choice words himself. But he described the MF and Green Tories west of the band. He says, it's my problem, the party. And that's how he described John Hume and the rest of the bunch in the SDLP. The situation was then that the strike kicked off. I wasn't up, I was in the office in London there. I really started calling up Derry, because I call up Derry, you know, without any clever reasons. And it's very hard to fit London Derry in when you're singing the sash. It just doesn't fit in the scene. So I left I was in the office in Derry, and I got a phone call from Andy, and he came on the phone, and he says, you're going to have to get up here right away. I says, why, what's wrong? He says, it's an absolute shambles up here. It really is unbelievable. He says, Lenny, you need to get up right away. So I dropped everything I was doing, sent out to the house, got out a couple of shirts and underpants and what have you, and battled up the road, and had a colleague with me, and I nearly didn't make it, because I think I have a fair reputation of being a bit of a low flyer. And I just got outside Tomb, the old road Tomb, and I stuck the boot down. I was just clocking 80 miles an hour, and all of a sudden I hear this merciful crack. And the fellow beside me says, what the hell is that? I said, I don't know. So it was a column gear change that I had around it. And he says, well, I put my foot on the brake. Nothing happened. He says, pull on the handbrake. Pull on the handbrake. Nothing happened. I started to get through the gears and nothing happened. As it turned out, I'd broken a half shaft of the car, whipped around, broke brake pipes and everything, smashed everything out of use. And I just got past the little garage on the other side after I left Tunbridge, and there's a grass verge. And I swear blind to you, it ran the whole way, the car ran the whole way up to the crossroads, which is the guts of, what, over half a mile, I think. So it gives you an indication about the speed of his travelling. But I knew then that we were going to do something positive, because God was on my side. This is on everybody's side when they pull a stroke like that, you know. I reached Belfast, and so, as I say, stayed with Andy, so that was me there now for the fortnight. And we started talking over, and there was a whole problem, and they said to me, look, we'll go in tomorrow morning, we'll sort the things out. The leaders will be all there. There'll be three from each of the paramilitaries, and there'll be six from the workers. And I immediately thought, well, that's a hell of a size of a committee to start with, but anyway, let's go and see what happens. And we went in the next morning, and Billy Kelly was complaining that the workers are getting all the blame for this strike, and we need the paramilitaries to do a bit of give them a hand. And of course, me, Harry Murray, he wasn't too keen on the paramilitaries getting too much involved, but it was a case of they had to get involved. And the UDA is the largest party, the largest paramilitary group at the time, was asked to take the lead in that. I just felt that the whole thing was so unwieldy, and there was no business being done really at all, because every couple of minutes there was a knock on the door and somebody wanted to speak to Andy Terry, and Andy would leave for a while, and the next thing somebody wanted to speak to Ken Gibson from the UVF, and Ken had to go, and Billy Mitchell had to go, and it was just out and in traffic the whole time. So I went to get them all sitting down, and I said, you know, if you want me to continue to manage this, first thing is I'm cutting this committee down. There'll be one from each of the paramilitaries, and the workers can have three. That stage, the only politician was there was Bill Craig, who had declared, and I mean this seriously verbatim, Craig declared, I don't think this will work, but he said, I'm in it, sink or swim, I'm here until the death. And for that statement, Bill Craig seriously got all the support that he wanted from the paramilitaries afterward. Anyway, I said to them, tomorrow morning we'll meet at 9 o'clock, one from each, and three from the workers. And I put three men outside the door, and I said, don't care who comes, who knocks, who they're looking for, Nobody gets out and nobody gets in. If Vaddy Terry hasn't gone to the toilet before he goes on, too bad. They could use the flower pot at the back of the room, but he's not getting out. So that was the attitude we adapted from day one. That meeting would have met for at least an hour, and we got reports from the fields coming in to us in the morning, and then we then took decisions. We then took decisions on how we would operate for the next 24 hours. At 10 o'clock we broke and we had tea in Vanguard headquarters, and after the tea at 10:30, the larger group assembled then. We bought 3 inch meats to the paramount police and 6 inch for the workers. And they were now the fellows that had they were the runners who knew how to distribute the information throughout the organisations. And that was done very effectively. Now, people say to me, that's a marvellous master plan you've had. It wasn't a plan at all. Seriously, we were in the wing of a prayer. And the way I got out of it, many occasions when people used to phone up and people used to talk, and they had a complaint, I used to give them the phone number of the Northern Ireland office and told them that was the number to ring with complaints. And the next thing we heard was the Northern Ireland office were complaining because their phones were all chock-a-block. But there was no master plan. And the workers, there was no doubt about that Billy Kelly himself did a superb job as far as the power workers are concerned. And there's no doubt about it, the paramilitaries. And yes, they get blamed for heavy tactics and all the rest of it. But the one thing that Andy and I stressed throughout the whole strike, there was to be no confrontation with the security forces. That would destroy us. And so the men who put up their barricades were told if the army came along with their diggers, let them knock them down, go around the corner, build another one, or they'll not stay there 24 hours, and as soon as they go away, build it up again. So that was the attitude we adopted. No confrontation whatsoever, because that's the very thing that will turn against our people. And the only blight for me on the northern side, of course, the terrible happenings of Dublin took place, the 3 bombs that were set up at Dublin and Monaghan. And for years I never thought it was any of our paramilitaries, the one I thought was the British, until I was then convinced that it was the UVF. But not being disrespectful, it was one of those situations that we were so engrossed in what we were doing ourselves, it was so important that we got things right, and the strike committee, and Andy and I in particular, that it would have slightly went over your head. But the thing that brought it back to reality, of course, was the murder of the 2 brothers outside Ballymena, which again was a terrible thing and was nothing to do with this, but because the fellows were linked to the strike got the blame for it. But it was important to us that we did not have confrontation. All full-scale confrontation with the security forces would have destroyed the entire operation. As I say, we reacted on a daily basis. We were getting phone calls from groups of workers over the country who wanted to come out and strike. We analysed, was it right to bring them out and strike or keep them going? And we took the decision that we felt best, whether they did keep them going or put them out. Bobby Pagels was shifted down to the centre of the town, down to E.T. Greens, I think it was, the time the feed suppliers to the farmers. And he controlled all that food stuff that was going to the farmers. And he was given carte blanche authority to decide what he thought was best at the time. And there's other people who were given tasks throughout the country in various areas. And particularly because of the UDA structure at that time, there was representatives all over the country. So it meant that easily the message could be passed down to the UDA and hopefully with the support of the UVF and the other paramilitaries. We put up our barricades. We manned our protest points. And people were frightened. And there was no doubt people were frightened. And what the whole concept was to get through to people, this was not another Vanguard 1-2 day under. We were in this for the until the end. And we were asking people to commit themselves to it. Now, there's been an argument in history about they should have moved the army against us. I don't know what the army could have done. I really don't. The only people who could have made any impact would have been moved the RUC in. And it surprised me they didn't take that decision, but they did that in 1977, and we saw the fruits of that. But as far as the British Army was concerned, They were all told if the army comes in, let them knock your barricade down, go around the corner and build another one. And after the second or third day, the people in the streets had got so behind the strike that there's no need for barricades anymore after the second or third day. And they threatened to put the army into the power stations. So we threatened to pull all the workers out. And I think that they had bad experience with them using the army before in power stations. And by the time they'd back in again, it cost them a fortune to try and repair the damage that had been done. And then, of course, the strike went on. We manned our own stations for petrol and diesel. And when they put civil servants on to run the petrol stations, we wouldn't deliver to them. So and then they decided that they were going to take over the distribution of bread. And I said to them, you take over the distribution, you'll bake it. They said, what do you mean? I said, we'll pull the bakers out. They said, but you can't do that. I said, well, just did it because I just told them to come out and strike. And the last one, of course, was then the sewage workers. And they said, okay, the sewage workers want to come out. And then, of course, sewage was to be running down the streets, and I think that scared the living daylights out of them. But I suppose that poor Paisley was always getting the butt of it. And I remember distinctly there was two occasions after he did come in. And first and foremost, I think that as I said, Bicoli, he didn't come in anywhere near, so he was in Canada. And then he did arrive in, and I saw him. We had already started the first meeting at 10 o'clock in the big bay window in Vanguard headquarters, and I saw him tromping in, and the next day I heard a bit of a kerfuffle outside the door, but he never appeared. And it turned out that they wouldn't let him in. So three fellas outside with three burly lads, and they said, you're not getting in. And they said, do you know who I am? And I remember one lad, Jimmy, said, oh, we know who you are, but he says, you're not as big a man out here, he says, as you are out in the street. And he says, there's a man in there bigger than you, and he's telling me there's nobody getting in, there's nobody getting out. So he says, you're neither getting in nor getting out. So you shall stay there until the meeting's over. So that's when he came in, and the famous story of the chair. I was out for my tea, and the carver chair was up at the top of the table. And when I came in, he had plonked himself down in the chair. And I said, Ian, that's my seat. You have to move. So we started the whole story about a bad back. I was travelling on a sore back and all that. I said, that's right. I says, take the chair down and move down the room. But I says, that's my seat. That's where I'm sitting. And he says, well, can I not keep the chair? I said, you take the chair. I says, furthermore, there's a couple of boys in Belfast minding the door. And I says, will you give Ian a handy shift that chair? So the three boys got round the chair, started left hand chair and all. And I said, so he said, well, hold on then. He says, hold on. So we very quickly jumped up at that. So the back wasn't as bad as he thought, or as he had been telling us. So he took the chair down on him. But on every occasion, the Craig was playing solidly with the group. The other two, Harry West and Craig and Paisley, were always trying to score something and get points for it out in the country. And I remember we took a decision on feed farm for the farmers. And we caught Harry West phoning out some farmers to say that he'd got this stuff released to him. So he was told he wasn't allowed to use the phone anymore. And for the duration of the strike, he wasn't permitted to use the telephone anymore. And, of course, the doc, he was going to London. And he says that at that stage, the people, the airliners, the fellows in the airport had pulled out as well. And he wanted the planes left on so he could fly back and forward to London to make our case in Westminster. And I always remember Tucker Little said to him, it's true then. It's not true. Paisley said, what do you mean it's not true? He says, you can't walk in water. So he didn't take that too well. And of course then he asked for his buses to be run on a Wednesday night to the Martyrs Memorial Church. And Andy Terry says, okay, you can run your buses to the Martyrs Memorial Church, but you let me lift the collection. So we didn't take that one up for that either. So that's the way Big Ian was treated within the meetings. The situation, as I say, on the very last day, the strike. And I want to make this point. very, very seriously, because it certainly affects a lot of what people thought out there and all the rest of it. And it unfortunately wasn't taken on board. I had nothing to do with the 77 strike. I advised Andy not to have anything to do with it. Because they lost the very basic point. We did not defeat Brian Faulkner. We did not defeat the British government. The British government pulled their support from Brian Faulkner, and Brian Faulkner collapsed. Brian Faulkner was quite prepared to go on, and I'm sure Morris will make that point. Brian Faulkner was quite prepared to go on if it had the support of the British government, and he was left no alternative but to resign. And on the very last day in Stirling headquarters, when all the reports were coming in all over the country, Andy and I were heading back to his house that night at about 9 o'clock, and the people were lighting fires and they were out singing and dancing in East Belfast. We had to drive through them, and it was the same when we got to the Shankill, pick up to Glencairn where Andy lived. The people were out in their hordes, bands were out, and everybody was celebrating. As far as they were concerned, the strike was over. Andy and I knew we had a very serious problem. We hadn't won what we set out to achieve, and that was fresh elections. And when we drove back from Andy's house the next morning to Vanguard headquarters, the people were going back to work. So I said to Andy, we do have a serious problem now. I said, we can't continue the strike, and he agreed we couldn't continue the strike. So when we got to Vanguard headquarters, we called the meeting, and we said the strike's over. And I know there was one or two fellows who weren't too pleased about it. But we knew that if the strike was to continue, Andy was going to have to put the UDA back in the streets, and we were not prepared to do that. That defeated the whole concept of what the strike was. And people didn't like it, but they had to lump it. And as I say, you know, people have argued over was it right, was it wrong? What is the strike all about? But as I said at the start, the loyalist people had taken such a terrible batter over those, from 1969, 1968 up to 1974. No consideration was given to them about how they felt. There was no consultation with them when their government was taken away, their institutions were taken away. And 1974, I think, was the last time that the loyalist people held their head up, and the last time they had got a lift from the depravity and that they felt themselves in, and how that everything was now lost. Well, at 77, and I have to speak out of 77 because that's been a bone of mine all my life, Paisley did not get credit for 1974. He didn't deserve any credit for 1974. The only politician that committed with any credibility was Bill Craig. And he felt that he had to have another strike. He wanted his strike. This was to be the Paisley strike in 77. And it was such a flimsy excuse to increase security. We're going to have a strike. You know, they could have increased security by 25,000 on a Friday, took it back out on a Monday. There was absolutely no purpose to it. And I had nothing to do with it. I had resigned in 1976 over the Voluntary Coalition row. There was something that, as I said to you earlier, about Huey Smith and myself, and how we could see the divisions being created within Stormont itself between the various people who were making up the executive. And we knew for a fact, and we heard afterwards, that the executive was about to split. And the one thing we did have was, of course, the success of the strike, if we call it a success. We had marvellous weather. If it had been raining and the wains were all night in the house, the women would have went crazy. They were outside, they were having picnics, they were having barbecues. The weather was absolutely superb. And of course, my great friend, Paddy Devlin, he decided that he didn't want to create any hardship for anybody, and he paid everybody the dole 3 weeks' money in advance. And to me, that was the commitment, and that was the make of the man. And Paddy and I had remained great friends after that. Indeed, I was one of the people who sponsored his European, not that it did him any good, unfortunately, in the European election. But that was the measure of Paddy. His thought was for the ordinary working class people, and therefore he didn't want to see them starve. But in 1977, we didn't have that. There was no real point of focus to bring our people together to rally them. And another thing is a good shop steward. I said this to them. We had plenty of shop stewards involved. And I said, you know, you've had what you call a success in 1974. You don't have to have another strike. Bluff. And the government will never, ever know if you can do it again or not. Keep them guessing. But the minute you call another one, it has to be better than 74. Otherwise, it'll be seen as a failure. And boy, was that a failure. And the authorities did do what I thought they might have done in the first strike, was they used the RUC and not the British Army. And the other thing was that Fellow Jackie Scott, one of our shop stewards, rang me and he says, Andy wants you up to advise him on the strike. And I said, Jackie, would you tell Andy I'll go up and advise him how to get off the strike? I can't, and nobody can advise Andy how to win the strike. And I said, the first thing that he has to do is get off it and let leave Paisley holding the baby. Because if he doesn't do that, Paisley will leave him holding the baby. And that's precisely what he done. Andy got the blame, and Paisley marched away. And remember the famous words, if this doesn't work and you don't support me, I'll retire from politics. And how long ago was that? And how many times was that? And the age-old problem we've always had is that the ordinary working class were used again. We were brought into the rabbit hole. And when the dirty work was done and over, and all the plaudits were being handed out, they were shoved back down into the rabbit hole again. And that's the difficulty of being associated with the paramilitaries, the loyalist paramilitaries. You get all these great people, and they did in 1974, jostling up against you to get their photograph taken alongside you. But if you had dared mention the fact that they were thinking of marrying one of their daughters that are on a mile. So that's the way we've been treated down through the years. And they tried the same thing, the victory rally, as they called it, in the Ulster Hall. And the hall was packed to capacity. I was on the platform. I guess we don't think they did get was to get on the platform, and the politicians were all talking one after the other about forming this new organisation and a new committee to organise the loyalist people, unify them and all the rest of it. And so they were electing a committee. They didn't elect anybody from the paramilitaries. They didn't elect anybody from the workers. So I got up in the Ulster Hall and I lambasted them what they were and what I thought of them, and I demanded places on that committee for the paramilitaries and the workers, and they conceded on the platform. And we had a meeting afterwards in which we were then to meet again, but we never did. We never met again. As soon as the paramilitaries then were demanding a position and representation, it was denied them.